Hello, I'm Jeff Horwich, and this is The Week from In the Loop. First, on this stock market stuff, y'all just need to stop freaking out. I'm not freaking out. Japan, Europe, quit freaking out overnight, so I have to wake up in the morning with your hangover. Everyone take a weekend and just chill. At least the NASDAQ was up today, suggests Apple and Google might be kind of like the cockroaches of this particular nuclear winter. When we emerge, they'll still be right there, nibbling on our dead skin cells. Anyway, we've thrown three economists at you in the last 2 weeks, so we're not going to dwell on the crisis today. Instead, let's turn first to something almost as depressing. Three debates down, one to go. All the focus this week, as usual, was on who won or lost. Here's my take on it. Everybody lost, because the debates so far have been stinkers, especially the presidential debates. Adrian Christensen is a professor at McAllister College here in St. Paul, an expert in political rhetoric. So thanks for coming in to talk with us.
It's my pleasure.
I sat on my couch on Tuesday night, like in a stupor, and it just kind of hit me. These debates are so, so bad in like every way that I can imagine.
I agree. These set of debates are neither good television, nor good drama, nor good politics. And this year, I would say, in the two presidential debates, they're just not very interesting. Typically, the very concept of debate has at its core this notion of clash, a conflict. We didn't hear very much of that in the first presidential debate. We heard more of it in the second one. But I'm reluctant to even call what we've heard so far a debate at all. That sets an expectation of conflict that's not happening.
How did the format of these debates, whether it's the town hall or the standard debate, how did it get so rigid, so just like boring and stale?
The candidates have a vested interest in only agreeing to formats in which they think they will excel. They have a certain way of talking on the campaign trail. So John McCain, for example, he loves the town hall format. But let's be very clear, that's not a debate. A town hall format is simply a small audience of people who get to ask questions directly to the candidate.
It's a question-asking
and
session.
He answers them in a kind of informal setting.
Right. I want to ask you about the moderators. What do you think of the moderation so far? I'm not impressed.
I'm not either, but I wouldn't want to be in their position. They don't have any capacity to enforce the rules. So you saw that particularly in the debate with Sarah Palin. She simply said, I'm not going to answer these questions the way you want to. And in fact, she didn't. Not even answering the question.
Gwen Ifill can't just jump in and say, wait, is it, you know, you agreed to show up and answer questions. Right.
She could have said that. And in the first presidential debate, that was a debate format where there's supposed to be more back and forth conflict and interactions.
Weird.
It was weird. And John McCain even said during that debate, you know, I don't really like this back and forth stuff. Let's avoid this.
Well, they didn't make any changes to actually facilitate that. It was just like, hey, give your answer to the other guy. Turn and look at him.
Right.
That doesn't change the nature of the conversation. They're both going to go in there and do their thing, and they did. And Jim Lehrer looked like a group therapist, like talk to each other.
Indeed. No presidential candidate would agree to a debate, I predict, if the moderator had the power to continue saying, sir, you have not answered that question, because it would be embarrassing to them. So they like the format where they have a brief answer and not much follow-up.
For Obama, it seems to be that he will speak in as many generalities as he can, vaguely addressing the topic very generally. McCain speaks in specifics, but oftentimes what I'm hearing is they're not really relevant specifics, like talking about the financial bailout, and he'll just talk about cutting earmarks for the umpteenth time, as if that's going to fix the crisis on Wall Street. There's nothing we can do to make them give us something that's more useful, not to mention more entertaining, for voters.
Absolutely. There's one thing we could do if we would stop watching these debates because of this behavior, and we're able to communicate to them that we're not going to watch these until we see what we need.
As you watch these debates, do you actually hang much blame on the candidates themselves, or are they in a system that really they have no choice in the matter?
You bet I blame them. It's been said that Americans get the politics that we deserve, and so if we don't hold them to a higher standard, they won't meet it. They're at fault to the extent that they negotiate for the most neutral, generic, kind of bland debate format possible. So they're absolutely at fault for this. But I would say as well that the moderators are. The media and the moderator want to have access to these candidates. They don't want to create a set of conditions where the candidates say, I refuse to participate in this because the risk is simply too high. Mm-hmm. So everybody has a vested interest in ratcheting it down. And so that's why we get these things that are not debates at all, but we call them debate.
Adrian Christensen, thanks very much for coming in.
It's been my pleasure.
Adrian Christensen is a professor of political rhetoric at McAllister College. While political passion might not be cropping up where it should be in the debates, it is creeping in this year to one place a lot of people think it shouldn't be. The other day, I drove past a church in my neighborhood with a politician's campaign sign out front. Pretty sure that's a no-no. And on Sunday, 33 religious leaders around the country staged a coordinated protest by getting political from the pulpit. The IRS says churches, like all nonprofits, must not endorse candidates if they want to keep their tax-exempt status. And that 50-year-old rule has been hard for some people to take. Gus Booth leads War Road Community Church in far northern Minnesota. He's become kind of the poster pastor for this whole thing, and we're glad to have him with us on the phone. Thanks for talking with us, Pastor Booth.
Hello, sir.
How's it feel now, 1 week after, to be officially out as a political pastor?
I guess it's fine. I mean, what I did from behind my pulpit, you know, even though people try to associate with politics, it's really just me applying the scriptures to moral issues of the day that happen to be the political issues of the day.
What exactly did you say to your congregation on Sunday?
Just basically endorsed John McCain simply because he has more moral positions.
More moral positions that line up with
yours.
That line
up with Scripture, yeah. And the two major ones are abortion and homosexual marriage, and he is against both.
And I understand you've been pushing the line on this for some time, right, before finally just going out and saying, vote for John McCain.
Well, you know, I've been the pastor here for almost 8 years, and I've always, every election year, given a sermon on whom I think the best candidates are, and I've always stopped from endorsing simply because the IRS says that I shouldn't. But then I realized that the IRS has made a law that is in competition with the Constitution. You know, I don't lose my First Amendment freedom of speech rights when I step behind my pulpit.
I know you've gotten lots of mail from all over, but I'm curious, how does your own congregation feel about you basically standing up there and telling them how to vote?
I think they're proud and honored. You know, there are some people that say, you know, don't tell people how to vote. You know, they can think on their own. But the very nature of being a religious leader is to tell people what the Bible says. So when I have a guy that comes into my office that says, you know, I'm thinking about cheating on my wife. What do you think, Pastor? I'm going to tell him to only have sex with his wife. So if I can tell him what to do in his bedroom, I can certainly tell him what to do in the voting booth.
How's an Obama supporter supposed to feel sitting in the pews at your church?
If somebody wants to come to my church and continue to vote for Obama, that's fine with me, for goodness sake. They'll just be, in my opinion, sinning as they do that.
Aren't you also saying that when it comes to the American election, you have the inside track on what the Word of God is? Or you know that Jesus would vote Republican in this case? How can you know that?
Well, it's pretty simple. It's just you choose the candidate that more lines up with what Jesus said.
Aren't there a whole lot of other things that Jesus said that very well could lend themselves to supporting a Democrat in the race?
Yeah, there are some. There are more for the Republicans.
You've added them all up?
Yes.
Do you have the math handy? I'm
well,
curious.
That's got to be the math handy.
Interesting calculation.
You know, basically, you look at the moral issues and you make your judgment commensurate to what the Scripture says.
We've got a statement from the IRS, not very specific, but says they are monitoring your situation and will take action as appropriate. Do you care if you lose your tax exempt status?
Well, I don't want to lose it, but you know, I don't think that the IRS has the right to censor religious speech from behind the pulpit.
And this whole thing is about forcing a court fight, am I correct?
Yes.
In the best possible scenario here, is that what happens?
We hope to just overturn that law.
So this has been litigated before. The case the IRS cites is Branch Ministries versus Rosati, which I think was in 2000, and the church is lost in that case. What are you hoping would be different this time around?
Well, I don't know of that case at all, but I think the facts of the case are different simply because there hasn't been any litigation from religious speech from behind the pulpit. My conversations with my attorneys are such that this has not ever been challenged in the court of law.
Have you heard anything from the IRS yet?
That's the one question that I cannot answer, according to my attorneys.
All right. Well, Gus Booth, pastor of War Road Community Church, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome, brother.
I don't know why people don't call me brother more often. Feels pretty good. I'm Jeff Horwich, and you're listening to The Week from In the Loop. We're online at minnesotapublicradio.org/In the Loop. You can subscribe to the podcast and have it delivered to you each and every Friday evening. I wonder if Pastor Booth would agree with me that as the markets crashed this week, we saw some other evidence that the end times may be near. Of course, there's this report that 25% of the world's mammals are in danger of vanishing from the earth. I hope they're not talking about my cat, because I really do like my cat. And Iceland, this beautiful, idyllic little island of Bjork and hot springs. The news makes it sound like they're about to revert to third world status. You know it's bad when you have to go to the Russians for a loan. Rumor has it Russia might get a military base on Iceland in return. But maybe the biggest sign of the apocalypse, the number one movie in America this week, is Beverly Hills Chihuahua. Let me just let that sink in. Could that movie have succeeded in any circumstance other than the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression? Lucky little Chihuahuas. As the crisis has gotten deeper and deeper, I've noticed it has taken the wind out of a lot of advertising campaigns. Charles Schwab, E-Trade, Citigroup. Really, what are these places supposed to tell you right now about investing in retirement when the markets are down like 40%? Up until the crisis, Ameriprise, this financial advisor firm that's actually based here in the Twin Cities, was running these ads constantly with Dennis Hopper. You know, you've probably seen these things. Well, they're still running. I'm not quite sure it's the same ad I remember. Listen close.
To withdraw, to go away, to disappear. That's how the dictionary defines retirement. Time to redefine. Watch the things that you've given your life to broken and stoop and build them up again with worn out tools. I don't know whether you've really thought much about it at your age, but it's all just a fantasy at this point.
At Ameriprise, we wish we could make the stock market go up again. We've tried. Nothing seems to work. But come in and see one of our advisors. We'll sit down with you and figure out just how screwed you are. And we'll help you plan how to get through the rest of your days with way less money than you thought.
I was going to go into shipbuilding, but I mean, what do I know about shipbuilding?
It was good of Dennis Hopper to come on in and recut a few lines for him. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is The Week. And let's pull ourselves back into the realm of reality here, away from the financial crisis and into the equally cheerful topic of terrorism. This week, the U.S. Army released a 200-page manual that embodies a major change in doctrine. It basically says the Army's job now is not just to fight wars, but to maintain stability around the world. Hence the name for this book, the Stability Operations Field Manual. On the phone with me right now, Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel. He's retired from the Army and now with the Center for New American Security. But before he retired, he was very active in helping to develop this new doctrine. John, thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure, Jeff.
Is this kind of a more technical code for this dirty word of nation building? Are we finally just admitting that for the Army, nation building is something that the Army does, that it has to do?
So absolutely fascinating, isn't it? The current president, George W. Bush, ran on opposition to nation building. He said he wouldn't have the 82nd Airborne escorting kids to kindergarten, speaking of a bit scornfully of American efforts in Bosnia and Kosovo. Then, of course, September 11th happened, and if instability in a place like Afghanistan can cause terrorists to have a safe homeland from which to attack us, we can't let them have that safe homeland, and we've got to build a more stable government that has some degree of control over those territories. So stability everywhere in the world is now the business of the United States, and we're going to have to build some capability to do that, and it's not going to be inexpensive, and it's not going to be fast.
Well, one way to read this is saying we didn't do Iraq very well, but we're going to do a lot more Iraqs, and we're going to try to get better at it. That doesn't sound very appealing at all, I'd imagine, to a lot of Americans who would rather we never got into that enterprise to begin with.
That opinion is certainly understandable. But whether you agree with the invasion of Iraq or not, I haven't met anybody who doesn't agree that the United States had an absolute responsibility to go after the leadership of the Taliban and the leadership of al-Qaeda. And frankly, al-Qaeda is still around, and the Taliban is resurgent in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and that all hints at the fact that perhaps we don't have the capabilities we need to do this right.
Now, the rest of the world, if and when they crack open this book to have a look, could perhaps see this as, we're getting all ready to come out and muck around in your countries, because any instability there, as you said, is our business now. Is that a fair reading? And it sounds like a very difficult public relations move on the part of the Army.
If that were what we were saying, it would be. But in fact, what I think the rest of the world will perceive is that the United States has not done as well in Iraq and Afghanistan as it should have, and that it would be very helpful if the United States had a better capability to pacify and stabilize societies riven by insurgencies and internal conflict. no one in the world benefits from a Taliban that is in control of Afghanistan and of Pakistan, which is a nuclear state, except for al-Qaeda. All of the civilized countries in the world don't want that to happen. It is in everyone's interest for the United States to be better at stability operations and counterinsurgency to prevent, frankly, the forces of darkness from becoming even more powerful.
Does the field manual have much to say about when we go into an unstable situation, or is it really just about what we do when we get there?
It does not. Those decisions are not made by the Army, but by the President of the United States and by the Congress in most cases.
Let's say I'm one of these soldiers of the future. Mm-hmm. What am I going to be studying? What am I going to be learning more of in lieu of all those hours on the firing range?
You're still going to have to spend some time on the firing range. The core competency of the Army remains the use of violence to accomplish national objectives. But you're also going to need increasingly some cultural competence, being able to work inside other societies, some language skills, an understanding of economics, and increasingly an understanding of the justice system while maintaining the ability to succeed in offensive and defensive fights. That's a lot to ask of a great young 18-year-old man or woman who has volunteered to serve his or her country in a time of war. But the kids I've seen, the great young Americans who are doing that, I think can handle it.
John, it's been good to talk with you. Thank you.
I've enjoyed it, Jeff.
Retired Lieutenant Colonel John Nagel with the Center for New American Security. He blogs about military matters at smallwarsjournal.com. I'm Jeff Horwich. With markets plunging this week, confidence on the run, a huge government intervention, the time is ripe for conspiracy theories. Lots of people are skeptical of the bailout. Some people are really skeptical. Whether he likes it or not, our producer Sandon Totten has a direct line to the conspiracy-minded. Here's what he knows.
Listen closely. What I'm about to tell you is above top secret. The financial crisis, the bank closings, the stock market drops, it's not what you think. In fact, it's not a crisis at all. It's a carefully orchestrated act, one designed to make you panic, to sell off your stocks and give more money and more power to the government. And it gets worse. The bankers, the politicians running our financial house, they're all aliens. Okay, maybe not. But on websites and message boards all across the internet, conspiracy theories about the economic crisis are spreading faster than you can say Zapruder film. I know this because, well, my eccentric Uncle Peter is one of those people spreading the word.
Before I sent you emails, but it just seemed like nobody was listening, so I just gave up.
The aliens part, he doesn't believe that. But he does think there's a shadowy group of Illuminati behind all our current problems. Uncle Peter says they control all kinds of world events, even the financial crisis.
Especially the financial crisis. If you look at the history of financial crises, you can see that they were orchestrated by certain elite groups of the population for personal benefit.
Right now, this secret sect is making trillions, even while the markets fail.
It doesn't fail for them, it fails for you. In the long term, all of the wealth belongs to a small group of bankers. They become the dictators of the world, and everybody becomes their slaves.
Okay, I know my uncle's theory may sound a little out there, but he's actually a really smart guy. His theories are backed up with a lot of research. He just gives them a different interpretation than most. And when it comes to something as vast as the global financial system, there's a lot of room for wild interpretations. You can find them posted in blogs or on YouTube videos.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been lied to.
It is a conspiracy to deny the next president sufficient
Wall Street, I don't believe the politicians. I don't believe the financial experts. I think there's a much larger thing at play.
One theory is that the government and Wall Street bankers know the economy is doomed. The $700 billion bailout plan is a lifeboat they've set up to keep them afloat when the economy really tanks. Others think the global credit crisis was created by powerful European bankers. They plan to use the downturn to force the world to use a single global currency. Then there's the camp that says it's all a distraction, just a way to drum up panic so the U.S. government can give itself enough power to eventually declare martial law. A lot of this may sound like total wingnuttery, but the point is, there are a lot of people, like my uncle, who are uneasy about the bailout. And despite the fact that congressmen were swamped with calls from economists and Joe Sixpacks asking them not to pass the plan, it passed anyway. The one thing all these stories have in common is that there's always some powerful figure hidden in the background pulling the strings. For some, it's shadowy overlords. For others, it's Hank Paulson. But either way, everyday people, they're powerless to do anything about it. And conspiracy or not, that's a very scary thing.
That's our producer, Sandon Totten. The Week is produced by Sandon and...
Can I come in?
Sure, just wrapping up the show here, I guess so.
Hey, Mr. Harwich.
Oh, well, hey there, Jimmy. Have a good week at school?
It was okay, I guess. But, Mr. Harwich, I'm confused by all the terminology around the financial crisis.
Well, you're certainly not alone, Jimmy. I think many of us are having trouble following all this stuff.
Like my third grade teacher said, mark-to-market accounting regulations are a big reason companies are in financial trouble.
Wow. What class was that in?
Introduction to Corporate Accounting.
Oh, you must go to a magnet school. Well, let's see if we can help you out with some of these terms. Come on over here, Jimmy. Now, suppose you went out and bought something that, for a while, you're going to own.
Like a baseball card?
Sure, or maybe a bunch of bundled mortgage loans. But let's say your all-star baseball player trips and breaks his leg. Suddenly, trying to sell his card is like trying to sell a rotten egg. But he might heal up great, might stage a big comeback. That card could regain its value if you just keep it in the pack. Companies are holding lots of stuff that looks like junk right now. It might bounce back by the time they sell, but they have to declare it anyhow. They have to mark the stuff they own to the market price, you see? It makes them look more shaky than they actually might be. Well, at least that's what they say. Others think it's just good, healthy transparency.
Gosh, that's nifty.
Yep.
But there's another phrase that's got me confused, something awful.
Okay, what's that one?
What the heck is commercial paper?
Oh, yeah. That's a ridiculously fuzzy name for something that's really fairly simple and important. Now, suppose you got to school today, Jimbo.
Okay.
And digging through your pockets, found your lunch money running low. Your buddy loans you $5 just to get you through the day. You'll pay him back with interest in a week, that's what you say. But suddenly, a bunch of kids flunk out or wind up broke. Lunch money lending seizes up, and the credit market starts to choke. Big companies take these short-term loans that don't run through any bank. They're not backed up by assets, so when confidence starts to tank, these commercial paper loans shut down, because no one dares to try them. These IOUs that no one wants, well, the Fed now says they'll buy them.
Wow! Thanks, Mr. Horwich. Now I'm all ready for my pop quiz tomorrow.
Hey, Jimmy, how do you know there's a pop quiz tomorrow?
Oh, I paid somebody off. It is a corporate finance class, you know.
All right, now I can do the credits. The Week is produced by Sandon Totten and me. We are edited by Kate Smith. Special help this week from Robin Johnson, reprising her role as Little Jimmy. And Jackie Fuller, reprising her role as anonymous voice of some financial firm. You can download this catchy tune and lots more of our little ditties at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. Fan us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, check out how you can help us build these shows each week. I'm Jeff Horwich. Seriously, everybody, this weekend, chill out.